Is that why you hit your wife? Withdrawn? Is that why you drink and pop pills? Withdrawn? Are you a virgin? Withdrawn.
Says here you robbed a hospital. Why'd you do that?
Yeah, I'm not guilty.
That's not what the other lawyer said.
Actually, I was going to stay in my office tonight and work on my law blog.
Of course, the blah 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 law blog. Wow, you, sir, are a mouthful.
The jury is instructed to disregard its own testimony.
Your Honor, the prosecution rests.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 116. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I am super excited about today's episode. How about you?
Me as well. We're going to be talking to Beth Kingsley later on about lock her up, about whether or not we need to investigate the Clinton campaign to determine if maybe the Democrats violated some election law. We're going to get a bigger picture on that, a more precise picture on that. And but in the meantime, we've got some good stories for you. We're going to talk about the changes to the bar exam. I think it was too easy for me, so they're going to try to address that. And then in the C segment, we're going to be talking about that. You may have seen the headline, the Senate struck down a rule involving suing banks and arbitration and stuff like that. We're going to get the Andrew breakdown on that. And I guess in the meantime, you've got an update on Phil Ivey?
Yeah, we covered Phil Ivey's method of, he claims, gaining an edge on the casino. The casinos claimed cheating way back in episode number 32 with our buddy, friend of the show, Chris Christofko. And he sent me notice today that a UK court has similarly required Ivy to pay back £7.7 million to the Crockford's Club in London for same edge sorting scheme, right? So teeny tiny little differences on the cards. If you want to hear and are a gambler, you can go back, listen to OA32. But at the time, we talked about how he'd pulled off this scam not only in the United States, but around the world. And now those dominoes are starting to fall. So
But I mean, if I remember correctly, it was kind of within the rules. So
yeah. No, this goes to show you, right? The house always wins.
Yeah. Yeah. Tagline.
The only good thing, I wish I had a pair of mirrored sunglasses to put on with that one. I could have said it more dramatically.
Definitely.
Get Brian to edit in some Who music in the background. No, the only good thing for Phil Ivey is that he's paying back £7.7 million, and I think the pound has lost about 50% of its value since he
smart.
Won it. So,
smart. Another layer to the scheme.
He's arbitraged. Couple million bucks there. But yeah, so what it goes to show you is don't try and beat the game. The casinos will come after you.
That wasn't as good as your first run. Sorry.
I'm gonna have to.
All right.
If I'd done two in a row, I would have to quit this job and become an action hero. And,
yeah, that's true. Okay. Well, let's talk about these changes to the bar exam. What's going on? Because my experience with the bar exam has been nothing but positive. I can't imagine needing to change it. I'm doing fine.
Yeah. So I have talked to you about the structure of the bar exam, and my knowledge dates back to, shortly after when dinosaurs roamed the earth. And so I have described the bar exam as containing the multi-state bar exam, the multiple choice questions that we're doing in TTTBE. And those are uniform across 49 of the 50 states. They exclude Louisiana because Louisiana follows the Napoleonic code. It's super weird. And so isn't a part of our common law traditions. And that's one day. And then typically you would have your state would draft in most states, including Maryland, it was 6 essay questions. And so you had a multi-state day and you had an essay day. And that's how I've explained sort of the Bardium. But as it turns out, there's been a movement recently towards making the bar itself cross-jurisdictional. And that's, you know, reflects the reality of today's law practice, right? Lawyers move, clients are in multiple states. So you have not only the MBE, the multi-state questions that we're doing, but multi-state essays as well. And 25 states and the District of Columbia have endorsed. When you put that all together, it is called the Uniform Bar Exam. And the idea is not only that it's sort of easier to administer, but you can waive into any jurisdiction that accepts the Uniform Bar Exam. If you do it, but you have to do so really quickly. Like you have to do it in a couple of years after taking the exam. That varies sort of state by state. And the interesting thing was, I have talked about Covington and Burling, and I've talked about big law as, you know, sort of these powerhouse multinational law firms with thousands of lawyers that are kind of the destination for most Ivy League law students. And they, you know, pay out the huge salaries and they work on these huge cases involving, you know, Fortune 500 companies that, that clog up the system. For the most part, states that have big law firms located in them have opposed the Uniform Bar Exam. I don't know why.
Huh.
But so you can take the UBE in the District of Columbia. They were one of the first. But the DC has always been weird, right? Like I never took. Most people don't take who practice in DC don't take the DC Bar Exam. DC is one of the is the only jurisdiction I know of that has always permitted you to waive in from another jurisdiction. So you would take, you know, if you wanted to practice in DC, even if you lived in DC, you would typically take either the Maryland or the Virginia bar and then waive into DC because right. You might as well get two for the price of one, which is what I did. I took Maryland, waived into DC. But so DC was kind of weird, but all the other states that had big law firms in it, New York, California, Illinois, Chicago, obviously, Texas, Florida, all of these states have resisted the UBE. But something weird happened in New York, which is in 2015, their bar rate passage hit a 35-year low.
Wow.
Yeah, only 70% of first-time takers pass the bar exam, and just 61% overall. And obviously, you know, when you're sorting out people who have taken the exam multiple times, those the reason you're taking it multiple times is because you failed it the first time, so that, yeah. That drags down your rate. So
that's,
you know,
still higher
six
than
out
I would
of
have
10.
Thought. Like 70% first time, I actually would have thought it would be lower. People talk about how hard this is, but I mean, now I, you know, that explains why it isn't that hard. But go on.
Well, you know, most lawyers do, you know, study for several months cramming before, yeah. Before taking it. And, you know, I mean, think of the flip side of it, which is, and this is really the push. If you spent 3 years in law school and you get out and you have a 6 in 10 chance of practicing in the profession for which you have spent 3 years and
figures. Well, it'd be the 71% figure, I'm guessing,
yeah,
right?
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yes, but, well, I mean, the 71% figure is skewed a little high, right? Like that's first time take, right? You don't know if you're going to wind up
taking
it in
more than one time.
That, you know, in that group, or yeah, if you're going to wind up in the repeat group. Yeah. So right, in any event,
but I just checked it real quick. The CPA exam is like under 50%. So that's a little harder.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So let's not do that segment. I don't want to be answering CPA exam. Or no, I'll have you answer. That'll
there we go. Yeah. That's spinoff podcast. I will do nothing but answer CPA exam questions. That'll be fantastic. Are there limits to how many times you can take the CPA exam?
Not that I know of. Yeah. Is there a limit
for the bar? You get 3 bites at the apple.
Oh, wow. And then you're just done? Like you're not a lawyer. Yeah. Someone right. comes yeah. up to you and is like, I don't know what you're going to do for a living, but it's not law. You are officially not a lawyer.
They do that. All of those here in this room who would like to practice law for a career step forward, yeah. And then they look at you and go, not so fast.
Yep, right? Yep.
So after New York rates hit their historic lows, and those were about 10 points lower than their typical rates, they decided they wanted to up their rates. Their reputation is that the UBE is easier than the traditional allowing states to write their own essays, because you're writing essays from the perspective of kind of the majority rule and common law rule across all jurisdictions. So, you know, it's a little easier to issue spot, you know, you can't quite throw in as many curveballs. The way the essay portion works is you can either allow the exam testing service to grade the uniform multi-state essays, or the state bar examiners can grade it themselves, right? And they can grade it. They have the option to either grade it under common law or under the specific law of the state, right? Because states do differ a little bit in their laws. You know, we've talked about that. So now those results are in from switching to the UBE. This is the July 2017 test. So by the way, that also answers the question of how long do you have to wait in agony to get your bar exam results? Mm. It's 3.5 months.
Yeah, that's a while.
Jeez. I remembered it being a long time. But yeah, so 3.5 months. And the New York scores are back up to 78% of first-time takers and 68% overall. That's right in line with its historic passage rates. So they're super happy. And, you know, we will see if New York being kind of the first big state domino to fall, whether that's going to lead other states to adopt the UBE. Here's how this works for you, because we've talked about there are a couple of jurisdictions in which you can take the bar exam without having gone to law school. There's still one, New Hampshire, in which you can take the bar exam without having gone to law school.
That's my ticket.
And it's the newer, easier UBE. So we got to get your flight out here as soon as we're
done.
How many
states allow you to take it on a podcast? There's got to be one or two, right?
Yeah, well, I think we should start lobbying the California legislature now. Yeah. That seems to be the best hope for finding that jurisdiction. So we're gonna bring you out to New Hampshire. We'll go up. You and I will rent a delightful bed and breakfast in Nashua, and we'll prep you. You'll go in and take the newer, easier uniform bar exam, and we will get Thomas's Second Chance Law Firm up and running.
Yeah. There we go. All right. Well, that's good news, test takers. let's attack that bar exam in New York, I guess. Or, well, I have to do it in New Hampshire, you said. But everybody else is gone to law school. All right. Well, let's get over to our main interview for today. We're going to be talking about hot off the presses news about the DNC funding that dossier on Trump. So let's go over to Beth Kingsley to get the full scoop on that.
So, Thomas, to answer the breaking news about the Clinton campaign and DNC funding the Russian dossier on Donald Trump, I brought on an expert.
All right.
So joining us is Beth Kingsley. Beth is a partner with Harmon Curran in Washington, D.C. She's a longstanding friend of mine, for good or for ill. And her specific practice area, she represents nonprofits with respect to their political advocacy. So it was really harder to find somebody who could better understand what was going on than Beth. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Glad to be with you.
So, okay, here's the landscape, and then I really, really don't want to have to do an Andrew Was Wrong segment. So if I can direct you in such a way
to affirm everything you've ever said.
No, please answer honestly. In episode 86, we talked about Donald Trump Jr.'s meeting with the Russians at their instigation, under the auspices of receiving a confidential information prepared by the Russian government.
Yeah, I think the email was something Hillary like, Clinton. Hey, Don, want to collude and definitely break election law? He's like, yes. I think that was the email. Okay, meet up here. And then they did.
And we analyzed that under the collusion statutes, but also under election law under 52 USC 30121. And expressed the opinion that opposition research counted as a, quote, thing of value for purposes of the election law. So I guess first question out of the box, did we get that right?
Yes. No, I think you got that right. I think maybe I can add a little bit of a gloss on that, which is there is an exception for volunteer services So if, you know, Natalia off the street in Moscow walks into the Trump campaign and says, I want to do work for you and conduct volunteer research or opposition research, that's not a contribution. But that's not what was going on here. It was fairly clear that this was a set of research that had been compiled by people working for pay in the service of the Russian government. So, yes, you got that.
Well,
right.
Well, and let me drill down on that a little bit. Is it okay? I mean, because that's new to me. Is it okay for Natalia, Russian official, in your
yeah, first question, is there a difference between like Russian official or Natalia who just happens to live in Russia?
You know, there really isn't in the election law. It just talks about foreign nationals and I think that's an area where we may see legislation, where we probably should see some distinction, because I think there's a big difference between the agent of the Russian government who is speaking on their behalf and, you know, Joe down the block, who's a student on a visa in the United States, you know, legally but not permanently, and has some interest in what's going on here, right? I mean, there's a range in between that. And the law doesn't really distinguish. Wow. It just says
so. Putin himself could have been doing it, same as if a student that just happened to be in the U.S. did it. That's crazy.
Yeah. So, but that's right. If Putin does it pro bono for the Trump campaign, right? If he shows up and says, "I'd like to lick some envelopes," right? That's okay under the election law.
I don't see. Sorry, I love the hype. I don't see. That makes it illegal.
Okay. Wow. So now I'm glad we cleared kind of hurdle one. Hurdle two comes in episode 93. We answered a question from conservative listener Sage Scott, who said, okay, I listened to 86. Clearly the problem is giving a thing of value. You've said opposition research can be a thing of value. So what if Donald Trump Jr. shows up at that meeting with a giant briefcase full of cash and just pays the Russians, right? It doesn't that get you around? I mean, leaving alone, I mean, you might get into some, banking and transfer laws, right? Like, but leaving that aside, if you pay for it, doesn't that eliminate the giving a thing of value? And don't you get out, get out of jail free from the violation of the election law?
Well, you would. I'm not sure that there's any indication that that's what was going on here. I think the email trail that we've seen doesn't suggest there was any interest in purchasing this information. Now, I mean, I don't think it's a slam dunk that it was intended as a contribution, because I just don't think they got that far. Mm-hmm. But it would, if you pay fair market value for services, you don't have to pay that to a U.S. citizen. You can hire the services of a foreign national or the work product. You know, you can buy your campaign T-shirts from an overseas company if you're willing to take the political heat for doing that. But that's also the key. If they had paid for it, I think you have to do that by check, and it would have been reportable. So you have this major disbursement to
Russians.
Agent of the Russian
government.
Yeah,
they just would write Russians in the check. And just
you right. Just make the payable to make the check Russians. Out to cash, yeah. Right? Like, let him stop by the local CVS and, you know, have to pay the 1% fee to cash it. But
well, you could make the check out to cash, but you still have to report. I mean, you would still be breaking the law if you didn't report it on the FEC report as a disbursement to that payee, that person for that purpose.
Okay. And does it matter if, in other words, is this a way to potentially launder illegal campaign contributions, right? That is, every time somebody says, oh, you know, I'm showing up with this, valuable campaign stuff, you just say, oh yeah, well, we were going to pay fair market value for that. Or does there have to be something? Do you have to have sort of set up that transaction in advance?
I mean, I think it's possibly a backdoor to get out of arguments about, say, criminal violations, because I think it's hard to prove a knowing and willful violation when someone could say, oh yeah, no, I meant to get a valuation of the information and pay for it. But it also doesn't get you out of laundering actual contributions, because if you know, what we have here is a meeting that didn't produce the contribution. We have the intent to show up and receive it, but at least, according to reports, it didn't result in the contribution. if it had, and he hadn't paid for it at the time, and they hadn't negotiated and presumably gotten their lawyers to review the way they're setting the payment and point out to them that they'll have to disclose, you know, payment to the Russian government on their next FEC report. But, you know, if you did that, then you have a quid pro quo transaction, and it, if it's at market value, it's not a contribution, it's not illegal. But I don't think that that helps you launder anything. It just gets you services.
Okay. So I think I'm following that, and I think that, that what that means is that the investigation, the corner of Mueller's investigation as pertains to Donald Trump Jr. is still viable, right? Like, in other words, that's not a reasonable, you have all the difficulties of proving intent, which obviously we've talked about on this show, you know, ad nauseum, but you wouldn't be able to plead as a matter of law, oh, you know, we never got to the stage where we were negotiating for the value for services. You would still be able to sort of make the argument that it was conspiracy to violate the election laws.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would need to know more about what happened at the meeting. I mean, I don't know that the emails themselves are sufficient to support a finding of a violation, but I think there's certainly enough to make you want to inquire further. If nothing else, it tells us that Trump Jr.'s reaction when he was offered the opportunity to break the law and accept an illegal corporate contribution was, sounds great. I mean, I'm sorry, an illegal foreign contribution. Right? And that makes you wonder what else he was doing.
Yeah. And so what, I mean, obviously, you know, an email, you know, hey, these are the goods, you know, signed, you know, love and kisses V Putin, right? Like that would be great. Mm-hmm. But is there anything sort of less than that that would be good circumstantial evidence in your view in the investigation?
I think that, if there may have been other communications, there may have been other, I mean, if there was just this one meeting, then I think it's hard to, other than getting testimony about what happened, so, you know, maybe getting someone who was one of the people involved in the meeting to roll, it's hard to know how you get that evidence. But that's why Mueller gets the big bucks and, you know, we're doing an investigation.
Sure.
I mean, you know, it's a hard thing to prove.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that brings us to the present. And now yesterday, actually, I think it was Tuesday night, the story was first broken by the Washington Post that Hillary Clinton's campaign plus the Democratic National Committee paid, and here's the chain. I think I've got this right. They paid attorney Mark Elias of Perkins Coie in Washington, D.C. Elias then turned around and retained a firm called Fusion GPS that has, if you search the Fox News website, I think every other story is about Fusion GPS. And then Fusion GPS hired Christopher Steele. He is an ex-British intelligence agent with an expertise in Russia, and he compiled the dossier on Donald Trump, which was then transmitted back to the Hillary Clinton campaign. So on the surface, right, the argument seems pretty straightforward. Here you have, admittedly, you know, through a more complicated chain of events, but you have the Clinton campaign paying a foreign national, that is Christopher Steele, for campaign information for this dossier. Is that, How concerned should we be about that? Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I don't think we should be concerned at all because they paid. I mean, that's the bottom line is you can pay foreign nationals to work on your campaign. There's any number of rulings, and it's implicit, it's inherent in the definition of a contribution, and that is what's prohibited, is a contribution by a foreign national, not a quid pro quo market rate exchange of services. So, yeah, no, I don't see an issue there. The only thing, what I thought when I read this, other than the political issue, I mean, I really think it's more a political story than anything. My question just had to do with reporting, because they pay their lawyer, who then hires a firm to do the research, and they hire someone else. And all you see on the FEC reports is payments to the attorney or to the law firm. But it is a fairly common practice to hire consultants through an attorney in order to try to protect their work under the attorney work product privilege or attorney client privilege. So, you know, I think that even my, is that an reporting issue question is probably the answer is no.
Well, let me drill down on that a little bit, because that was actually going to be my next question. Sorry. Well, no, it was good. You anticipated. As far as I can tell, the Clinton campaign paid Perkins Coie $5.6 million in legal fees during the campaign from June 2015 mm-hmm. to December 2016. And then the DNC paid the firm another $3.6 million, and that line item was described as legal and compliance consulting, which at least, I mean, I gotta tell you, like when I issue bills to my clients, I've got to be slightly more detailed than that, particularly when I bill them for $3.6 million. So now let me, you know, kind of wrap that up as a question. Isn't there a problem that, at least for right now, that the money doesn't seem to be differentiated, right? We have a ton of money going to the law firm, but who knows where that was spent?
Right. I mean, so to be fair, let me explain sort of what the paperwork probably looks like, because what you're seeing reported in the press is not a summary of the individual law firm invoices. And my guess is they are somewhat more detailed over the 18 months or something. I mean, it's not one bill that says, please write a check for $5 million, right? But then the campaign has to report its disbursements to every vendor. And you have to do it on this form that gives you this, like, I don't know, 1-inch by 2-inch square to write the purpose of the disbursement. And so legal and compliance services is about as much wording as you have room for. So that does not seem to me deceptive. It's sort of not as detailed as perhaps some people would like. But yeah, I do think the interesting question is how you treat the payments to third-party vendors that the firm retains to provide that representation. And if certainly it seems to me that if the campaign knows that the firm is doing that, I mean, you know, for instance, as an example, if the firm, say, hires an independent contractor to help with the compliance, with filling out those FEC reports, if that's part of the compliance work they're doing, I don't think that you want to make the campaign report the payments to that independent contractor separate from the payment to the law firm, right? It's all part of the service. But if they're basically running money through their lawyers in order not to show who they're paying, I think that raises some transparency issues and some reporting issues. But it's not, the facts in this particular case are not clear to me how much the campaign knew and what the intent was.
So I get that. And, you know, I think you gave this example earlier of, you know, the campaign having T-shirts or red baseball caps made in China, for example, right? Like we know if you're going to distribute, you know, large quantities of consumer wearable goods, that, you know, that's going to be done by foreign nationals. But I want to drill down on what you just said, which is what can we look for to tell the difference, right? Like, because I mean, I don't, you know, one of the things we try and do on the show is, I mean, I don't want to shill for Hillary Clinton here. I mean, everybody knows, you know, where Thomas and my politics lie, and you know, we have not been shy about that. But you know, how do we see if there's more there if they're covering up some shady payments or something like that?
Well, I think the first place you can start with is, well, if they're covering it up and not reporting it, then it's hard to know where you look, right? That's why you need an investigation with subpoena authority. But the campaigns are filing really quite detailed reports on all their expenditures. And that's why the reporters know exactly how much they paid their lawyers, which is a really big number. And you can go and, you know, you can search that, and the FEC makes it publicly available, and there are other organizations that make it publicly available in somewhat easier forms to manipulate and search. So that's where I'd start. You know, if it's clear that something came into the campaign, if you have evidence of that, you can go and try to find corresponding evidence of a payment. And if it's not reported, there's a problem somewhere.
So like the Perkins Coie bills, are they going to be attachments to FEC disclosures, or is that something that is going to have to be produced by, I believe Devin Nunes has already, you know, convened an investigatory committee. And so, you know, they can obviously subpoena those records, but are they presently out there, or are we going to have to wait?
They're not attached. they are the reports that are filed. Actually, there's two levels of this answer. The reports that are filed summarize. It's this, you use the FEC's report form and their reporting software, and it comes in its format, and you don't attach receipts or anything. But as I understand it, the presidential campaigns are all audited by the FEC for compliance purposes. And at that point, they can come in and look at the records and make sure there is appropriate backup and that things have been reported the way they're supposed to be. And they can audit other committees and other campaigns as well. It's not automatic for everyone, but it's a possibility.
So what are you looking for, Andrew? I mean, because it sounds like from the description early on that, I mean, if they paid their lawyer money, who paid someone else money, who paid someone else money, either way, they paid money, apparently. So it sounds like, you know, what would be the issue? Just the political aspects of it? Or do you think there's something like what would be illegal now at this point?
Yeah. So I would put this to Beth, but the language that Beth used was if you have paid fair market value in an arm's length transaction for the thing of value that was conveyed by the foreign national, then you're not running afoul of 52 USC 30121. But if you pay under market value, right? Like if it just showing a transfer of money isn't sufficient. If you paid over market value, you know, that would be weird. But so, you know, you would want to have, you know, if you're truly kind of looking to run this to ground, you would want to know, you know, exactly how much was paid to Steele for his investigation in compiling the dossier. Do I have that right? Or?
Yeah, no, you have that right. And the interesting thing in this case is I think you have a benchmark because as I understand it, and I'm going solely on the Washington Post article, so I have no other knowledge of these facts, but they're saying that some Republican entity, presumably I don't know if it was a primary opponent or some, you know, branch of sanity within the Republican Party, had originally hired Fusion GPS, who hired Steele to start this work. And then when it became clear Trump was going to be the nominee and they couldn't stop him, they let go of it and the Dems picked it up. And we don't know exactly how that transition happened, but, you know, we can see what was he paying, you know, and you could tell whether there was a discount between the rates that for the different clients.
Oh, that's a really, really good point. So, I mean, let me ask you a politically loaded question then. Given the uncertainties that are out there, is it a reasonable thing for Congressman Nunes to have opened an investigatory committee?
I don't think it's unreasonable to investigate, partly because I think that, and I think it's not unreasonable to investigate all of this foreign involvement in our elections, because part of Congress's role, in fact, the larger part of its role, is deciding whether we need new laws, whether the laws that are in place are sufficient to deal with what we see as problems. And, you know, I think with respect to foreign intervention in our election, they're not. I don't exactly know how they should be fixed, but there's an awful lot that, you know, Putin or his people he's directing can do that doesn't cross the line currently of U.S. law, but that we should be tremendously concerned about.
Well, it seems like step one, we need a distinction between just plain old foreign nationals and, you know, members of foreign governments and administrations, right? It seems like that would be step one.
My next question was going to be, so Beth, how would you fix this problem then? Seems to be right. Permitted.
All right, well, I took the easy answer. So now, Beth, you have to come up with something harder.
What else would I do? Well, I think that we have, so one of the things that we have been told that Russian operatives did to mess with our election was to buy Facebook ads that basically riled people up along fault lines in our country around, you know, talking trash about Black Lives Matter and targeting that to people who might be expected to react in particular ways and get angry and do things. There is nothing illegal about that currently. And it's hard to craft a law that makes that illegal without
stopping a bunch of other stuff.
Without really trampling on speech rights. Although, when I say there's nothing illegal about that, there might be. We don't know who did that. There is the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which requires anyone who's acting as an agent of a foreign government to conduct, among other things, public relations or fundraising activities or ad policy advocacy in the United States to disclose that fact. And they probably didn't. But FARA is complicated. It's really hard to comply with. It is, because it's so hard to comply with, it's under, and people don't register sufficiently or often. People who probably should haven't, and it isn't really enforced rigorously or hasn't been enforced rigorously because it's such a mess. And so I think that maybe having Congress take another look at FARA and make it something that captures more foreign agents, but in a way that is makes that is possible to comply with without completely going crazy. I mean, one of the requirements is that every single communication from a foreign agent has to have a disclaimer, that a fairly long and detailed disclaimer saying this is a communication from an agent of a foreign principal. And, you know, that doesn't really work on a Facebook ad.
How is that enforced?
Well, it's enforced by the Justice Department when it is. Mm-hmm. It's not. I mean, if you check FARA and shepherdize it and, you know, pull up all the cases, there's not a huge number.
No, I did. But what I'm trying to figure out is, let's go outside the collusion context, right? Let's assume you have candidate A running against candidate B, and independently Moscow decides, because candidate B is 70 years old with no political experience and of relatively low intelligence, that they would rather see candidate B win the election, right? And so then Moscow starts all these targeted Facebook ads to try and pump up candidate B. Again, totally without knowledge or communication with candidate B's campaign, right? And again, this is a hypothetical. So, I mean, on the one hand, you certainly couldn't have election laws that punished the campaign of candidate B, right? Because then you could metagame the system. You know, there was an old G.I. Joe episode that did this, right?
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
All of a sudden now, you know, the foreign governments would publicly intervene on behalf of candidate A because they really want candidate B to win, right? Like, you have to go against the Russians, but that kind of seems like a tough thing to do. So,
well, under current law, the only thing that is illegal for, other than contributions, and so if they're acting independently, we're not talking about contributions to a campaign. It's only illegal advocacy.
I'm sorry. I wanted to cut in before I lost. If a foreign government is agitating on behalf of a campaign for one particular candidate, that wouldn't count as a contribution, like an in-kind contribution to that campaign?
Not if it's independent.
Oh.
So that's this critical difference in the election law between what's called independent expenditures and contributions. If you don't talk to the campaign at all, and this is actually something that's at the heart of Citizens United, the distinction that corporations are still not allowed to make contributions to candidates, but they can at least allegedly independently advocate for or against candidates that they support or oppose.
Yeah, and we have Citizens United on the whiteboard, but it did not occur to me that the rationale of Citizens United applied to Vladimir Putin.
Well, it didn't. So the difference, no, it doesn't actually. I mean, well, so far, because the foreign national prohibition covers both contributions and expenditures, but expenditures are defined as involving express advocacy for or against a candidate. So just, touching on hot button social issues to get people worked up with an intent to influence the campaign is not going to be covered under current law. And I say with the footnote that there's still the FARA issue, but under campaign finance law.
Wow. How do we make sure that that is included?
Well, and one of the problems too in the modern world is that, you know, the Russian trolls are sitting somewhere in, I don't know, their mother's basement in Moscow or wherever, right? I don't know that we have a lot of jurisdiction over them. So it has to be either laws or self-regulation from Facebook and Twitter and the various vendors that are in Google, that are party to this, that are not currently, I mean, they're just placing ads, right? They're not making a contribution or receiving a contribution. but I think they have to be part of the answer.
All right. Well, now I'm just going to shout freedom for the next 10 minutes. Yeah. Wow. That's and that's sort of at the core of the enforcement question that that I had asked previously, right? Which is, once you've defined the thing that you don't want them to do, which would be difficult, it's going to be twice as difficult to figure out who's going to be in charge of not doing that, right? Because, you know, as you point out, it's really, really difficult for the DOJ to reach all the way to Moscow basements. So
you could have sanctions. I mean, you know, it could be a diplomatic issue. It should be a diplomatic issue when another country directly intervenes in our election.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, my impression was that the Facebook ads weren't regulated in the way that normally like radio and TV political ads were. And is there a reason for that, or couldn't we just start doing that?
Well, the reason for that is that the technology has been moving really quickly, yeah, and the law has not. And that, so partly the law hasn't caught up, but also the FEC actually looked at how it should regulate the internet, and the internet was not happy with that.
Yeah.
They got a lot of feedback about, you know, don't kill the internet. And I think there was a legitimate point in the early days to not coming up with a bunch of rules that were, you know, written in stone in, say, 1997, that we would now be looking at and saying, what, you know, how do we apply this? So it's been a largely hands-off approach, and complicated by the fact that in recent years, the FEC has been completely unable to get the number of votes necessary to take action on almost anything, and particularly anything controversial. It's a 6-member commission, three nominees suggested by Democrats and 3 suggested by Republicans, and you need 4 votes to do anything.
Hmm. Yeah, I could imagine a lot of issues with trying to regulate the internet in that same way, but it does seem like a really difficult loophole given that Facebook ads are so apparently effective.
Well, there is some pending legislation. I haven't had a chance to read the bill, but there's, or at least proposed legislation, to require just disclosure, a public file of, and I don't know how they've defined it, if it's all ads or political ads, but what ads are being placed, who's paying for them, and who they're targeted at. Because Facebook has that information, right? And so it's not that hard for them to put it into a file that people could see. And at least then maybe we can have some education and be aware of who's targeting those ads at who and be able to respond.
Yeah, that sounds like a really reasonable first step. It seems like, I mean, I guess if the, you know, you're talking about legislative solutions, and as we all know, our Congress cannot pass laws. But I suppose if there is, as this politically continues to unfurl, that, you know, if you get 70% of the country sort of in agreement with the broad principles that a great many ways the Russian government directly influenced the 2016 presidential election, then, you know, maybe you'd get some kind of political will to at least start to tackle these problems.
Maybe. And, you know, maybe, like, trying to play optimist, maybe some of these companies will decide that they want to be good citizens. Maybe they want to forestall more burdensome regulation or legislation, and they'll come up with some sort of self-regulatory solution.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point. And we have seen that with, you know, Facebook's regulations on hate speech and the like. So that's possible.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so we've come down. We've said that we
Andrew
are
was wrong, everybody.
Yeah. Devin Nunez's investigation into Hillary Clinton. Make America great again.
Yeah. Lock her up.
And lock her up.
Well, yeah. Actually, can I go back to my answer on that?
I don't think
it is inappropriate to investigate the foreign funds piece. I cannot believe we're going back to the damn emails.
Oh, yeah. Well.
But, yes, that aside.
We have been with you on that one since episode 13, so... Anything else I'm missing in asking on this story while I've got you on the line?
No, I think we've hit on everything.
Awesome. Thomas, do you have anything else?
No, I just, I'm going to gloat that you were wrong. But other than that, I don't know if Beth has to be here for all of that. So, you know.
Well, she's a loyal listener, so she'll get it twice now. So.
There you go. Well, thanks, guys.
Yeah.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
All right. Well, how many more minutes do we have for Andrew was wrong? Let's see. 15, 20. Yeah. So yeah, it sounds like, what are your thoughts? It sounds like the Donald Trump Jr. stuff. I mean, as much as we thought that was clear as Kushner, maybe it wasn't so clear as Kushner.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So, you know, I think ultimately where Beth came out was that, you know, we are still looking to see the results of the investigation, that you can still draw the inference, but that there's a lot there to kind of potentially muddy the water. I am flabbergasted that under the current election rules walk into Vladimir Putin's office and say, "Hi, I'd like to
contract your services.
Fair market value." Yeah.
Do you sell compromising dossiers? Oh, sure. We got. Yeah. What's the going rate for the? You know, I was gonna ask that, but it's not worth it, I don't think, because it just sounds like a different issue. But what in the world would be the fair market value for some of this stuff? Like, I don't even know how you would I don't even know how you would decide. Like, you could go based on some past precedent, but then that was just based on some past, but like, there's no, you know, like, it's just what someone decided to pay. So I don't know how you could make a big case that, like, oh, you underpaid for that, you know, dossier. It's like, what is that? I mean, what would we all pay for Trump to not be president? It would just be infinite money. So.
Yeah. There is the closest case that I could find is a case involving Grover Norquist. You may know, activist with Americans for Tax Reform, and has been active since the 1980s in getting candidates to sign no new taxes pledges. I think he was the one that got George H.W. Bush to say, "Read my lips, no new taxes." So his legacy is kind of mixed. You could probably thank him for Bill Clinton being president, but he turned over a list of donors to a Republican campaign, right, and was prosecuted under this same law, under 52 USC 30121, and that was the case that I found that backed up the notion that, you know, intangible political stuff can be a thing of value. So, you know, you have a little bit of precedent, but yeah, I don't know where you would begin to start determining fair market value for having an enemy power dig up dirt on your opponent. And notice we left open, you know, I asked Beth that question of, if it isn't a fair market transaction, then it still falls under the election laws. So, you know, so that it leaves some avenues open there, but yeah, my initial take was definitely, I thought that this was a much, stronger case, and apparently, you know, there are more nuances out there than that. So, that's why we go out and bring on the experts.
Andrew was wrong, everyone. Yeah. All right.
You are enjoying that.
Oh, no, I just want to emphasize. Okay, it is time to get to breaking down the law here. Down the law. Down the law. Down the law. Down the law. Now, a chance for you to be right, Andrew, because you're right like 99% of the time by volume. You know, if we measure it out, it's if we pour all your rightness into a vat and then we measure the volume of it, you know, it's you're most of the time you're right. So what's going on with this this rule that the Senate has killed? It doesn't sound great to me, but I don't know if it's going to be one of those things that sounds worse than it is. What's happening here?
Yeah. So this is, again, breaking news this week. If you are a past donor to Elizabeth Warren, which I am, you would have received about 87 emails in your inbox saying, be on guard for, you know, the Senate's going to vote on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau tonight, you know, and then a bunch that said, the Senate just, you know, gave a huge giveaway to Wall Street in their vote on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau tonight. So what's going on? First, you might say, wait, the Senate did something? How did that happen? And the answer is, this is you know, drum roll, please, one of these Congressional Review Act cases. And so what you have is a recent rule that was promulgated by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That rule essentially invalidated the use of boilerplate form arbitration agreements in consumer cases, right? So like when you sign your credit card application and it has several pages of text in 3-point font that no one ever reads, it includes, in many cases, many banks include a waiver of your right to sue for any reason whatsoever, and specifies that all claims pursuant to the credit card agreement have to be arbitrated, typically pursuant to the auspices of the commercial arbitration rules of the American Arbitration Association. Now, why is that a bad thing when we're talking about consumers and credit card companies? Because, you know, you've heard me, and this was actually a question, it was sent in by a listener that said, hey, I've heard Andrew say good things about arbitration agreements before. And that's true. It was Eric Johnson, a patron, who asked us. And that is true. When in my day-to-day practice, right, when I have a business owner, a small business owner, and that's what I represent, our entrepreneurs, small business owners, who come into my office and say, hey, I want to engage this contractor and I don't want any of us to be involved in a long, messy lawsuit, I will say, yeah, sure. Look, what we're going to do is we're going to put in your contracting agreement an arbitration clause. And the contractor gets to look at it and gets to decide, you know, do I want to do business with this company? Am I going to negotiate to take that provision out? But it's sort of knowing, I shouldn't say sort of, it is, in my view, and the reason I recommend it is a knowing and deliberate waiver of your right to sue. And, you know, in a lot of these cases, I mean, you think about, you know, small business contracts, this is not a situation where people really want to file expensive lawsuits against one another anyway, right? So I am a firm believer in arbitration, particularly in the business context, to eliminate uncertainty so that, you know, 6 months down the road when everybody is mad, instead of people being mad and filing lawsuits, they're just mad. Right? They're mad, but you know, you call them up and go, hey, remember we talked about that this might happen 6 months ago. And I would add, whenever I have asked anybody to sign an arbitration agreement on a contract containing an arbitration clause on behalf of my clients, I have disclosed exactly what that is to them, right? Like I think that's part of my obligation is to say, hey, look, this says if you need to sue us or we need to sue you, instead of suing, we're going to arbitrate. So that's the way arbitration, in my view, is supposed to work. When you have a situation like an individual has a credit card, the issue that happens is your credit card company, you discover, has been overcharging you. They've inserted a $1 service fee that you never requested, that they didn't disclose, and you didn't notice it for the past 13 months. And so now they owe you $13, and they've done it to 10 million customers, right? So now they've made $13 million. Each individual's injury is vanishingly small at that point, right? Nobody is going to file a lawsuit, even a small claims lawsuit, for $13. But that's where you use the vehicle of the class action. And we've talked about in prior episodes how because of the requirements of Federal Rule 23, it's really hard to bring a lot of class action cases, right? Like it's hard to bring a class action mass tort case because the injuries suffered by individuals when they're exposed to, you know, your pollutant or whatever are not likely to be typical across the class.
Right.
But a consumer fraud case is really, really, right? Your injuries are all the same. Everybody had to pay the extra dollar, right? So it's a really, really useful vehicle. It's not, let me be 100% honest. It's not useful for getting the consumer their dollar back, okay?
It's useful for making lawyers' money, though.
It does two things, right? Number one, it makes plaintiffs' lawyers a lot of money.
Right.
And number two, because it makes plaintiffs' lawyers a lot of money, they have the incentive to be out there policing these kinds of cases, and they have the resources to bring cases against Citibank, right? Whereas the average individual does not, right? So yes, there's an inefficiency in the process, and we can talk about, I think this is on our whiteboard, but you know, we can talk about plaintiff's contingency fee practices, but there is certainly something to be said for law firm calls you up and says, hey, you don't have to do anything other than, you know, add yourself as a name to our class, or maybe be a named plaintiff. And we want to go out and bring this lawsuit against Citibank to make sure they stop doing this kind of, you know, predatory behavior where they sneak the extra dollar in on your monthly bill. And that has a pro-social effect, right? In that it hopefully deters Citibank, or at least forces them to hire more clever lawyers to come up with a worse scheme. So yeah, so that's the dynamic. Eliminating plaintiffs' class injury lawsuits against giant commercial institutions is then a double win if you're a member of the Republican Party. It is a double win, number one, because plaintiffs' class action lawyers are almost always Democrats and give to Democratic candidates. And number two, it's a win for those mega businesses that tend to give money to Republicans. So you get to hurt the other guy and benefit your constituency all at the same time. So that's the rule that the Senate struck down 51-50 with Pence casting the tie-breaking vote. And if you're wondering who are the two people who voted against it,
Murkowski
the
and
two
Collins.
Republicans. No. Lindsey Graham and somebody, freshman senator named John Kennedy from Louisiana. Don't know anything about him at all. But yeah, so if you have been putting out accolades for Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, John McCain, Olympia Snowe, Lisa Murkowski, they all lined up to vote with the Republican majority on this. There are some really neat findings in the rule itself that I think really show, regardless of politically kind of where you come out, that in my view differentiate these kind of waivers from the typical use of arbitration that I've talked about. So the CFPB conducted a survey of 1,004 credit card holders. And one of the things they asked was, do you know that your credit card requires you? And they asked the question as, if your credit card imposed a surcharge on you that you didn't authorize and they refused to take it off, are you allowed to sue your credit card company? Mm. And what they found was that more than half of the respondents whose contracts had pre-dispute arbitration agreements thought they could litigate anyway.
Yeah. Right?
56.7%.
I have never read a single thing involved in any of my credit cards. I don't even read the statement. I don't read anything. I just have an amount and I pay it.
That's right. And that's and when you think about that, I mean, I do the same thing. Everybody does the same thing. And that is called, you know, boilerplate or, you know, contracts of adhesion when, you know, you don't really have a choice. Like you can't scratch out a line and send back your agreement and be like, no, I'm willing to take your credit card, but, you know, we got to change terms A, B, and C. Like your credit card company is just gonna be like, nope, not issuing you a credit card then. So, but when you dig down into the lack of knowledge, it's even, to me, it's even more, right? So 56.7, okay. I was like, wow, I'm kind of surprised 44%, you know, knew that they're 43%, you know, knew that they couldn't.
I would
maybe
almost
they
imagine
just thought,
there must be some other explanation for that. Like they just thought you're not allowed to sue people or something. I mean that.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's right. Because when you dig into the numbers, so here's some of the findings. This is page 46 to 48. They say respondents were generally unaware of any opt-out opportunities. Only one respondent, so that's one out of 1,004 whose credit card contract permitted opting out of the arbitration agreement, recalled being offered such an opportunity. When asked an open-ended question about all the factors that affected their decision to obtain the credit card that they most often use for personal use, zero respondents volunteered an answer that referenced dispute resolution procedures. When presented with a list of 9 features of credit cards, features such as interest rates, customer service, rewards, and dispute resolution procedures, and asked to identify those factors that factored into their decision, respondents identified dispute resolution procedures as being relevant less than any other option. So in other words, people don't know that this is in their contract. They're not making a decision as between two credit cards, right? Because rationally speaking, if you have two credit cards on roughly the same terms and one says you can sue us and one says you can't, you ought to prefer the one that gives you more remedies. Nobody does that, right?
Right.
So it's verifying exactly what you've said, which is people don't read it. They don't know what's in it. And that's kind of the exact, again, you know, we have listeners that are across the political spectrum. In my view, if you're going to have a consumer finance protection board, that's the kind of thing you want the Consumer Finance Protection Board to be doing, right? Intervening in situations of grossly disparate power where people don't know when they've given up their rights. That was the point of the rule. That's why it was promulgated, and that's why the Senate killed it.
Well, there you have it. Thanks, okay. Republicans. With that said, yeah. I think we'll have to get to let's cheer ourselves up with our co-favorite segment of the week. And that is Top Patron Friday.
Yay, Top Patron Friday. Yeah, thank you to our Hall of Fame patrons. Thank you to Heather Loveridge, Sakashite Fukasumi, back in civvies and covered in dishonorable discharge, Kaylee Reiser, Chrissy offers job coaching at blueprintgreen.us. Use code OA17 and save. And if you haven't taken advantage of that, you should. Violet Page Hall. And finally, thank you to the Grand Duke Niall, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Greg Sullivan, C6 Sarah, Sammy, Roger Metcalf and the Hired Goons, great, great band, Rhonda the Dork, Rebecca Smelzer, I believe she just had a birthday, our first patron, Danny Rosari, that is true, Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Docking, The Wayward Willis Podcast, Philip Stromberg, Tricicular Manslaughter, CampQuest.org, Squick Finger, All Aboard Thomas Smith Purge Boat, Matthew Vernon, POTUS Supports Sick Poor People, Malaika Chandler, Jesse Stutt is my favorite lawyer, Andrew's a close second, Jaga, co-host of the Shifty Bastards Transformation Podcast, Keith Davies, and Jessica Wilson.
And thank you to Jeffrey Maynor, Jared Middlegoon Manager Teets, Jim Grove, Dave, co-founder of the Florida chapter of Thomas's Goon Squad, Nichols, Ian and Allie, manager of all our tentacles, Matt Dillahunty ate Thomas's feet with his goatee, Fantasy Costco sells murder boats and prenuptials, Eli Bosnick, Sam Danow, Soggy Pants, Adam Lenda, Aaron Grady, Frederick Alstromer, Cody Bond, ReasonableRiskPodcast.com, 3x3, say it, Thomas, say it. Mitchell, no, I'm not going. Okay, I'll say 2. ReasonableRiskPodcast.com, okay. We met in the middle-ish. Mitchell, stop breaking the law, asshole. Eric Johnson, Dan, the socialist man. Michael, Thomas's chief goon, Rop. Moe's Tavern, home of the Super Sunday Brunch Spectacular. Zabby. Carl Zippel's Overton Window Cleaning Company. And finally, Conrad Michaels. Thank you, top patrons, for making the show go round. We can't thank you enough. And the names are just cracking me up every week.
I actually had a good friend of ours told me, Jeremiah told me at PastaCon that reading the patron names on Friday is his favorite part of the show. So shout out to you, Jeremiah, for enjoying that. Although I think there's maybe an implicit like left-handed compliment.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know if that's a good, but okay, sure. I mean, maybe we should up the rest of our show, I guess, if reading names is
I guess
best,
so. Yeah.
And now it's time for our co-favorite segment, our co-favorite segment, which is Thomas Aces the Way Too Easy Bar Exam.
Yeah, we are down the home stretch here. Just 3 questions left. I guess 4 counting this one. Here you go. A tenant's 4-year-old daughter fell from a second floor outdoor stairway at their apartment building. The tenant sued the landlord for negligent construction and maintenance of the stairway, steps, and railing. The stairs were built on a dangerously steep incline, the steps were loose, and the railing was insufficient to keep the baby from falling over the side. The jury found that the landlord was negligent in the design and construction of the stairs and in failing to maintain the stairs, steps, and railing in a safe condition. The landlord appealed on the basis of immunity from suit and the failure of the tenant to assert any exception to landlord immunity.
What?
Under the modern rule, will the appellate court affirm the jury's verdict against the landlord? So, shut and dried case, landlord appeals on the basis of landlord immunity. Is the appellate court going to affirm the jury's verdict against the landlord?
Oh, great. Cool. So this relies on my in-depth knowledge of the landlord immunity rule. Okay.
Right, right. Which file. Yeah, you discussed at great length in both civil procedure and in torts class. So okay. No problem.
You just think all right. Back.
A, yes, the landlord is strictly liable for the abnormally dangerous condition that he knowingly allowed to exist. B, yes, the modern rule is that the landlord, like anyone else, has a duty to use due care to protect its tenants and others from injury caused by a foreseeable risk of harm. C, no, because the landlord still enjoys the common law protection of the doctrine of lessee beware, and residential property is generally still rented as is. Or D, no, because a landlord cannot be held liable for negligent design or maintenance, even under the modern rule.
All right. Well, I've thought back to all my knowledge of the modern rule, and it's just nothing. But so, okay, considering that, what would I guess that the modern rule will be? Well, let's see. I'm going to, in terms of eliminations, it seems like there's a clear cut answer if one were to know what the rule was. And I think I can eliminate, boy, this is really hard. Because the ones I want, okay. If I'm using my issue spotting thing, I would say that, you know, B and D are probably the one. I mean, they involve the modern rule. That sounds like the question we're evaluating. However, A seems like totally reasonable, as in, yes, the landlord is strictly liable for the abnormally dangerous condition that he knowingly allowed to exist. I mean, that sounds reasonable, but is he strictly liable? What is this modern rule? You know, what is it involve? Maybe the modern rule means that sometimes the landlord is not liable for certain things depending on how they go. I don't know, but I'm gonna go with my issue spotting, you know, that you've taught me, and I'm gonna take a chance and eliminate A, which was yes, the landlord is strictly liable. That was kind of just basic strictly. I mean, that'll be wrong if it turns out this was one of those trick questions where it's like, nah, the modern rule has nothing to do with anything, and it's just kind of trying to trick you. But I'm gonna take that chance. And then C is no, because the landlord still enjoys common law protection of the doctrine of lessee beware, and residential property is generally still rented as is. So I'm going to hope that it is about the modern rule, and that would leave us with B and D. So B was, yes, the modern rule is that the landlord, like anyone else, has a duty to use due care to protect its tenants and others from injury caused by a foreseeable risk of harm. And D, no, because a landlord cannot be held liable for negligent design or maintenance, even under the modern rule. And I, you know, I'll just guess B. I mean, it just sounds like, again, with the caveat that the bar exam, as we've covered, always involves like an incompetent judge or jury or whatever at the lower court level that just doesn't know about a rule, usually. So that would be D. But anyway, I'll go with B and just say, yes, the modern rule is that the landlord, like anyone else, has a duty to use due care to protect its tenants and others from injury caused by a foreseeable risk of harm. It sounds reasonable to me. I don't know. We'll see how this stacks up. Could be. Yeah, this is one where it really could be any of them. Like, it wouldn't be, in my opinion, there's no like, oh, that's obviously a ridiculous answer. You know, I mean, even C, I wouldn't, it seems possible. So, tricky question.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree.
It really seems like every answer could be it. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if I'm right.
All right. And as always, if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share or retweet out our episode on Twitter or Facebook. Include the hashtag TTTBE, your answer, your reasons, therefore. And on Tuesday's episode, when we read the answer, we will pick a winner and shower that person with never-ending fame and fortune. Never-ending fame and fortune, not guaranteed.
All righty. Well, that's it. Thank you so much, Andrew. Thank you so much, Beth Kingsley, for coming on and educating Andrew about the law, because someone has to do it.
Someone has to.
Thanks for listening, and we will see you guys on Tuesday.
Stop breaking the law, asshole!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.